Last week we saw that the first king of Israel, that is King Saul, was not a man after God's heart as God wanted the leaders of his people to be. And as a result, God rejected him and set his eyes and set his sights on another who would be a man after his heart, one who would be a righteous king or a king that would reign in a relationship with God over his people. So today we're going to start seeing that new king. We're going to start seeing that guy who becomes the second king, and that is David. And over the next few weeks, we'll see a number of stories dealing with David and with Saul's relationship with David. To get us into this and see where the Israelites have been, where they're going, and what's happening today in today's lesson, let's kind of look back. After the Israelites left Egypt, you know, they had Moses and then they had Joshua. So they had leaders chosen by God, men after God's heart, that would lead all of Israel and kept Israel righteous. And during their times, although they fell away from God and were not the 100% faithful people that God demands of all of us, they still lived in a faithful relationship with God because of the leadership while Moses and Joshua were there. Now, after they went on, what kind of leadership did Israel have after Moses and Joshua? If we look at Judges chapter 2, we remind ourselves, verse 16, that God raised up judges who saved the Israelites out of hands of raiders. Okay, and then in verse 18, whenever God raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. So what we see is during the period of the judges, after Joshua, we no longer had a central leader per se. Instead, there were hierarchies of leaders within the tribes, and so you had tribal leadership, but then there was no leader that brought all the tribes together, and so you had more of a loose confederacy in Israel at the time. And we've seen, when we looked at those stories, we saw times when the tribes would work together and come together as one country, as one people. But we also saw times where the tribes would fight against each other as if they were separate people. But there was no central leader. Instead, whenever there was a crisis that would pop up, and that crisis would pop up because of Israel's apostasy or their unbelief or their turning away from God and towards other gods, God would allow these raiders to come in. And then when they would return to him and return to faithfulness in God, God would then raise up a judge who would save them out of that problem. So the closest thing we had to central leadership were these judges that would pop up. Okay? Did Israel feel that they did have a supreme leader? Judges 8, verse 23, Gideon's response here is... gives you a flavor of their feeling. This is after the Israelites wanted Gideon to become their king and rule over them because he had saved them. And he says, I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. Yahweh, God, will rule over you. And that was their view. They did have a king. They did have a central leader, a supreme leader, and that was Yahweh, the Lord their God. And that was the best king you could ever have. And as long as you lived under the reign of that king and obeyed that king and lived as subjects to the king, you couldn't ask for a better life. You couldn't ask for a better kingdom. But when you rejected that king and turned towards other kings and strayed away and disobeyed that king, then problems happened. And that's what the Israelites saw, is those kind of problems. So how well did this situation and this kind of leadership work out for Israel? Back to chapter 2. Verse 19 says, when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. And then if you zoom to the very last verse of the book of Judges, you see that in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. So, they had problems. They had problems that people didn't follow God. People didn't obey him. Now, during the life of the judge, after the judge saved Israel, they remained faithful during that time. But once that judge died, the people returned to their evil and corrupt ways. In fact, it says even worse ways. And we see that that's because they didn't see that God was their king, and everyone did as he saw fit rather than as God saw fit. So that kind of set the stage, and that kind of set the problem for the Israelites. We then saw at the beginning of the book of 1 Samuel that God raised up a prophet, a judge. He raised up a judge, Samuel, who would lead the people into faithfulness and righteousness. And during the life of Samuel, he brought that. And Israel did live during a time of faithfulness. Well, as happens to all of us, Samuel grew old and neared the time when he wouldn't be around anymore. So what did the Israelites decide they needed when their last and greatest judge grew old? Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You're old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." So they saw that Samuel wouldn't be around much any longer. They had this central leader in Samuel. Even though he wasn't a king leader, he was a leader. He led the faith. He led the Israelites to be righteous people. And Israel was blessed as a result of it. But as they saw that Samuel was not going to be around much longer, they said, "We need a leader. We need a king. Give us a king, just like these other nations have." Now, why did they want this king? Did they want the king because a king would help keep them faithful, like, and therefore blessed by God, as was happening under Samuel? Later in the chapter, verse 19, the people refused to listen to Samuel. "No," they said, "we want a king over us. Then we'll be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles." See, they weren't even looking at the main reason for having a leader, and that is to keep them faithful. They were looking at, they wanted a king so that they could have a military leader just like the other nations have. And why did they want that? Because they didn't trust that God would protect them as God had promised that he would protect them. They saw these other nations with their central leader, and they wanted a central human leader as well. We saw that Samuel didn't like this. He was upset by this. Why? Your first thought might be, well, because they're rejecting him. But God told him, "Samuel, don't take this personally. They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me." But he was still bothered by it. And he spelled it out as after he anointed and appointed Saul to be king, he then went before the people and he kind of laid it down as far as what his concerns really were. And you see that in 1 Samuel chapter 12, starting at verse 12. Samuel told the people, he said, "But when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, was moving against you, you said to me, 'No, we want a king to rule over us,' even though Yahweh, your God, was your king. Now, here is the king you've chosen, the one that you asked for. See, Yahweh has set a king over you. Now, if you fear Yahweh and serve and obey him and do not rebel against his commands, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow Yahweh your God, good. But if you do not obey Yahweh, and if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you as it was against your fathers." So that was his concern. His concern was, okay, you've got a king, but having a king doesn't solve it. You need to remain faithful. Your king needs to remain faithful. I pray that God will keep your king faithful. I pray that you will stay faithful. If your king turns unfaithful, that could easily lead astray the nation. And so that's the bottom line. That's what Samuel was really concerned about, is Israel being faithful, staying faithful, because of having a king that would be and would remain faithful and keep Israel faithful. Okay? All right, so that's his concerns, and that's what Samuel lays out in front of them. Now, they get their first king. How does Israel select their first king? We've won a king. Okay, how do we get one now? Whoever wants to start fighting, and whoever wins is the king. Well, that's the way maybe other nations would do it, but that's not how the Israelites did it. How did they do it? 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 15. Now, the day before Saul came, Yahweh had revealed this to Samuel. "About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him leader over my people Israel. He will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. I've looked upon my people, for their cry has reached me. So how did Israel select their first king, King Saul? God chose him. Okay, God chose him. God led him to Samuel. Samuel didn't choose him either. God brought him to Samuel and said, this is it. Well, being that he's the first king, did he at least look like a king? Verse 2 of the same chapter. Kish, guy in Benjamin, land of Benjamin, had a son named Saul, an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than any of the others. So you see, he looked big, he was big, physically impressive, head and shoulders above everyone else in height. You get this picture of a strong, impressive man. So yes, he would look like what they would expect a king to look like. Right? So he had the looks. How about the action? Did he act like a king? Did he have the confidence of a king? Chapter 10, verse 21 to 23. I'll start at verse 20. When Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. Then he brought forward the tribe of Benjamin clan by clan, and Matri's clan was chosen. Finally, Saul of Kish was chosen. But when they looked for him, he wasn't to be found. So they inquired further of the Lord, has the man come here yet? And the Lord said, yes, he's hidden himself among the baggage. So they ran and brought him out as he stood. And as he stood among the people, he was a head taller than any of the others. So does he have the confidence of a king? No. No. In fact, when Samuel had first anointed him and told him that he would be the king, he says, hold it, who am I? I'm a nobody. Verse 21 of chapter 9 says, but am I not a Benjamite from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me? So he didn't feel that he was kingly material. And you see his reaction when Samuel had gathered all the people together to present to them their new king. Saul wasn't ready to be presented. He was hiding. Okay. Well, okay. But then he became king, and everybody saw that he was king. So then did he act like a king? Chapter 11, verse 5. Just then, Saul was returning from the fields behind his oxen, and he asked, what's wrong with the people? Why are they weeping? Then they repeated to him what the men of Jabesh had said. We see that after Saul is announced to all the people and accepted by the people as their new king, what does he do? He goes home and goes back to work as a farmer. Okay? He does not take seriously his role as a king until something happens. Okay? Something happens that then prompts Saul to start acting like a king. And that's the story that we have in chapter 11. We'll start and jump around a little bit. Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. Now, Jabesh-Gilead was a town in Israel, but it's not a town in Benjamin. Benjamin was the tribe that where Saul lived. Jabesh-Gilead was over on the east side of the Jordan River, up further north in the land of Gilead, I believe. And oftentimes we saw during the times of the judges when there was a raider or a problem like this, God would raise up a judge in that local vicinity that would take care of that problem. Now we've got Jabesh-Gilead being besieged by the Ammonites, and word of that goes out into Israel, and word of that gets to Saul. And when Saul hears their words, verse 6, the Spirit of God came on him in power, and he burned with anger. He took a pair of oxen and cut them into pieces and sent the pieces by messengers throughout Israel, proclaiming, this is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel. Then the terror of the Lord fell on the people, and they turned out as one man. When Saul mustered them at Bezek, the men of Israel numbered 300,000 and the men of Judah 30,000. So what you see is it takes this crisis, and then Saul reacts to that crisis. And then the power of God comes on him, and he starts acting like a king. And he musters up the troops, and he starts acting like a leader of the people. And he leads the people into battle against the Ammonites at Jabesh-Gilead and rescues the city of Jabesh-Gilead. And then people say, ah, okay, he is a king. And then that's what we have at the end of chapter 11, is the people come back together again and confirm Saul as king. Saying, okay, we know we appointed you king before, but now we really believe it, that you are the king. And now we see Saul starts acting like and thinking like and believing that he is a king. So we see that he started acting like a king then at Jabesh-Gilead. What about later? Did Saul start acting like a king and continue to act like a king later when other problems happened? What about the next time? The next time Philistines attack in chapter 13, does he start responding like a king then? And we see that in verse 5 that the Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as sand on the seashore. And we see elsewhere that there were 3,000 in verse 2, there were 3,000 men in Saul's army. Well, there's a chariot, a Philistine chariot against every man, not to count twice as many charioteers, not to count more soldiers than you could count. So what happens? Saul remained at Gilgal with all the troops, and all the troops were with him, were quaking with fear. And we see that they were afraid, and many of them ran away in verses 6 and 7. And in fact, in verse 15, we see that all that were left with Saul by this time then, after about a week of this, was 600 men. Verse 8, Saul waited 7 days, the time that had been set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings." And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. So did he act like a king? Yes, it seems like it, right? He had an impending battle here. He had this massive force that was coming up against him. He was there trying to maintain the morale and the allegiance and the involvement of his army, and they were scattering. And knowing that as an Israelite leader, what he needs to do before he goes into any battle is inquire of God. God, do you want us to do this? How do you want us to do this? Okay, seek the Lord's favor. And he waited the week. Saul had been told by Samuel to wait a week and then Samuel would come. Samuel didn't come. So he knows, before I do anything, I've got to inquire of the Lord. So he did so, right? He sought the Lord with offerings, right? That sounds like the action of a faithful king. But if you remember last week's story, it was wrong. Why? Back to chapter 10, verse 8, we see that the last thing that Samuel had told him, he said, "Go down ahead of me to Gilgal. I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. But you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you are to do." So what was wrong with him inquiring of the Lord with these offerings? Well, number one, he wasn't a priest. He wasn't there to do the offerings, that he was overstepping his bounds. But most importantly, he had been instructed to wait 7 days and Samuel would come and do the offerings, and he disobeyed that. He wasn't patient enough to wait on the Lord, to wait on Samuel. So he disobeyed a command by God. That was a big problem. As the king of God's people, that was a really big problem. So how would Saul be punished for this undiscerning disobedience? Back to chapter 13. "You acted foolishly," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now, your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." So as a result of this disobedience, even though he thought he was doing the right thing, but his lack of discernment led him astray, as a result of that, his dynasty would not continue. His dynasty would end with him. So, strike one against King Saul. We then saw last week strike two in chapter 14. How does Saul next demonstrate poor leadership in chapter 14? Well, this is God gives them a victory against the Philistines, and they are chasing the Philistines and trying to mow them down, the Philistine army. Verse 24. "Now the men of Israel were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, 'Cursed be any man who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies.' So none of the troops tasted food." What kind of leader will not give his soldiers and give his people the strength that they need to be able to do their job? These people were chasing Philistines all day and they were getting worn out and starving, but Saul had cursed them. So Saul had put this oath on them that said, "No one can eat anything until nighttime. Spend all your time and attention and focus chasing these Philistines." Well, as the day wore on, these people wore on and they could no longer carry themselves and do the job that they were to do. So he weakened his army as a result of that stupid command. Besides weakening his army, how did this become a problem? Verse 27. Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath, so he reached out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it into the honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth and his eyes brightened. Or your NIV text note says, or his strength was renewed. Okay? So here he had made this command, but his own son broke the command because he didn't know anything about the command. And when he was confronted with that, he said, well, that's a stupid command. My father made a really dumb statement there. So how does Saul make a difficult situation even worse, especially after he finds out what Jonathan had done? Verse 43, Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you've done. So Jonathan told him, I merely tasted a little honey with the end of my staff. And now must I die? Saul said, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan. Okay, so he adds on top of that, on top of making this horrible command and so that prevents them from eating, he then says, Jonathan, you must die for this, and may God deal with me ever so severely if I don't carry this out. So he puts a curse of God on himself if he doesn't follow through with this punishment. So does he follow through with the punishment? Next verse. The men said to Saul, should Jonathan die? He who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel, it's because of what Jonathan had done, is that the Israelites had just conquered the Philistines. They go on to say, never, as surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help. So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. So we see that Saul does not carry through with the punishment that he said would happen to anyone who ate. He also doesn't carry through with the oath, with the promise that he had sworn to God, and may God deal with me ever so severely if you do not die for this, Jonathan. And instead of pleasing God, instead of fulfilling his command, his promise to God, obeying God, he instead follows man. He instead wants to please the men and doesn't kill Jonathan. Okay? It's not saying killing Jonathan was right, but disobeying God, breaking an oath to God, was even worse. So strike two. Okay? Big strike two against Saul as king. All right? Well, now we have a third strike in chapter 15 that we looked at. What command does God give Saul here in chapter 15 that then leads to his third strike? Samuel comes to Saul and says, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. And if you remember the story, soon after the Israelites left Egypt, after they crossed the Red Sea, these are not trained fighting men. These are slaves. And all of a sudden, this group of Amalekites attacks them. And this is that battle where Moses is standing on the hill, and as long as he has his arms up, the Israelites win. When he gets tired and drops his arm, the Amalekites are winning. So Aaron and Hur hold his arms up, and the Israelites end up winning that battle. But at that time, God had said to Moses, write this down so everyone remembers, and let them know for sure that I will blot out the Amalekites from the face of this earth later on. Well, now it's that time. Okay, God says through Samuel to Saul, now I'm going to punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel. Now, verse 3, go and attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. Destroy it all. The word there is hesed, which not only deals with destroying everything, but also devoting everything to God. It's the same word that's used when the Israelites were commanded to totally destroy Jericho. Okay, and that's what God tells them to do with the Amalekites. All right? Well, doesn't really sound like a big deal, does it? God is on his side. He knows he's going to have victory. This has been promised that the Israelites are going to destroy the Amalekites. So this is kind of a no-brainer deal. Let's just go wipe them all out, right? How could Saul screw that up? Verses 8 to 9. Well, sort of 7. Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur to the east of Egypt. He took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. and all his people he totally destroyed with a sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and cattle, the fat calves and lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak they totally destroyed. So they went, attacked the Amalekites, defeated the Amalekites, killed it all off except for the good stuff. What's wrong with that? That's wrong because God had said destroy everything, even the good stuff. Has said everything. Dedicate, devote everything to God. Destroy everything. So Saul disobeyed God here. How does Saul describe this and explain his disobedience to Samuel? And what's interesting too is when Samuel shows up, the first thing that Saul says to him, verse 13, Samuel reached him. Saul said, Yahweh bless you. I've carried out Yahweh's instructions. Okay, he says, I've done it. Just what you told me. It was great, Samuel. And so he says that I've done it. But he didn't. And Samuel goes, well, okay, what's the bleating of the sheep that I hear? What's the lowing of the cattle that I hear? So how does Saul explain all that? Turn to verse 20. But I did obey the Lord, Saul said. I went on the mission that the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites. And see, I even brought back Agag, their king, to show you. Okay? I threw a few extra words in there. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal. Okay? So how did he explain it? Hey, I brought back Agag to prove to you that we destroyed them, and the soldiers very carefully kept the good stuff so that we could sacrifice them to God. Sounds like the right thing to do, right? Let's have a great sacrifice to God. How does Samuel reply? Verse 23, does Yahweh delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. Okay? As much as God likes you to sacrifice to Him and to show your love to Him and your dedication to Him through your sacrificing, He wants your obedience more. And disobeying for the purposes of a sacrifice is not acceptable. So how would God respond to this third strike? Verse 28. Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. Okay, before he had said your dynasty would end with you, now he says God's going to take this away from you and God's going to give it to someone else. So it's not even going to wait till you die your long natural death. You're going to give up the kingdom to someone else. So strike three and he's out of there. Okay, that's where we left off last week. Now, what happened then? What happened after that? Did Samuel immediately go out to try to find a new king? Who is this new king that God has ready to take Saul's place? Chapter 16, verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, since I've rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to be king. So you see that Samuel spent a lot of time mourning a good while for the loss of Saul, that Saul would no longer be king, that Saul was not the faithful king that Israel needed. And then finally God said, come on, get up off your whining horse, Samuel, and go. I'm going to send you to Jesse. I've chosen one of his sons to be king. So you go get some oil, go and anoint him. Okay? Well, there's a problem with that. Saul knows that there's going to be another king. Saul knows that other king is going to happen while he's king. So he doesn't want that to happen. Saul knows that other king is going to be one who's going to be anointed by Samuel just as he was. So he probably has lookouts and spies watching Samuel's every move. Well, if Samuel's going to take oil over to Bethlehem, to Jesse, to anoint one of his sons, how's he going to do this without Saul finding out? Well, we see that Samuel's concerned about that. Going on, Samuel said, how can I go? Saul will hear about it and kill me. The Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Invite Jesse to the sacrifice and I'll show you what to do. You are to anoint for me the one that I indicate. So Samuel did what the Lord said. When he arrived in Bethlehem, the elders of the town trembled when they met him. Okay, they're going, okay, what are you doing here? We know that Saul doesn't like you very much, so we don't want to get on Saul's bad side, so what are you doing here? Okay. Do you come in peace? They asked. Samuel replied, yes, in peace. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Now consecrate yourselves and come to the sacrifice with me. And then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. So, you see, he had this ruse of going to Bethlehem for a sacrifice, but his real purpose was to go and anoint the son of Jesse to be the next king. Okay? So, at the sacrifice then, Samuel gets to meet Jesse's sons, and what does he think when he sees Jesse's oldest and strongest son, Eliab? Verse 6, when they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, oh, surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord. Okay? This is it. He looks like a king. He's got to be the one. What lesson did God have for Samuel here? Verse 7. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I've rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things that man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. That's a key word for us all to remember. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at his heart. Where is the beauty that God's looking for? It's in our heart. Are we people after God's heart? So what's more important then? Is it more important to look faithful or to be faithful? If we look back at 1 Chronicles 28, verse 9, and you, my son Solomon, this is David speaking to his son Solomon, acknowledge the God of your father and serve him with wholehearted devotion and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches every heart and understands every motive behind the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will reject you forever. So we see that God searches every heart. When God looks to see, are we his people? Are we acting as his people? Are we obeying him? He's not looking for the outward action and the false fronts that we may put on that may fool other people that we are faithful. He's looking at our heart. He searches our hearts. He understands the motives behind our thoughts and our actions. That's what he's looking at. So, Eliab was not the one. So, who was? Going on. I'll start at verse 8. Then Jesse called Abinadab and had him pass in front of Samuel, but Samuel said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. Jesse then had Shammah pass by, but Samuel said, nor has the Lord chosen this one. Jesse had 7 of his sons pass before Samuel, but said to him, the Lord had not chosen these. So he asked Jesse, are these all the sons you have? God told me I was coming here for one of your sons, but you've passed all your sons in front of me, and it's not one of them. Do you have any more that you haven't told me about? Jesse answers, they're still the youngest, but he's tending the sheep. Samuel said, send for him. We will not sit down to eat until he arrives. So he sent and had him brought in. He was ruddy with a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, rise and anoint him. He's the one. So which one was it? It was the youngest. The one that certainly did not look like a king. He was ruddy. That means he had a childlike appearance because he was young and was not grown yet. Did not look like a king, but that was the one. He was anointed. How does David's anointing compare to our own baptism? Verse 13, so Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers, and from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. Samuel then went to Ramah. So how's that similar to our baptism? Because it's at our baptism that the Spirit comes into our lives. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord is upon us as it was with David. And the power of the Spirit that's available to David is available to us as well. So how did the Holy Spirit's presence in David contrast with the kind of support that God had for Saul? Verse 14. Now the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. So God withdrew his spirit from Saul. No longer would he work within Saul, and that vacancy then lets it open for an evil spirit to come in. So Saul was tormented by this evil spirit. What idea was suggested to calm Saul from his torment? Saul's attendant said to him, "See, an evil spirit from God is tormenting you. Let our Lord command his servants here to search for someone who can play the harp. He will play when the evil spirit from God comes upon you, and then you'll feel better." So Saul said to his attendants, "Find someone who plays well and bring him to me." Okay? So let's go find someone who can give me some music. You know, they didn't have the radio back then. They didn't have CDs or records or tapes. Okay? If they wanted to hear music, they had to have a musician. And so go find a musician that will give us some soothing music. You know, what does music do for you? It's nice and soothing, or it can be. They went to go find someone, and who did they find? Who did they recruit to help Saul? Verse 18. One of his servants answered, "I've seen a son of Jesse of Bethlehem who knows how to play the harp. He's a brave man and a warrior. He speaks well and is a fine-looking man. And Yahweh is with him." Then Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who's with the sheep." So Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread, a skin of wine, and a young goat and sent them with his son David to Saul. So someone had heard about David, that he knows how to play the harp. So they sent for him, and his father Jesse agreed. Didn't really have a whole lot of choice. When the king asked for somebody, that somebody's got to go. But Jesse was fine with it and sent David on with gifts for the king to show his support of David working for the king. So did David's music do the job? Verse 23. Whenever the spirit from God came upon Saul, this evil spirit would come into Saul, David would take his harp and play. Then relief would come to Saul. He would feel better and the evil spirit would leave him. So you see, he did do the job, and what David's music did drive the evil spirit away from Saul. Did Saul appreciate David's presence? Verse 21. David came to Saul and entered his servants. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. Then Saul sent word to Jesse, saying, "Allow David to remain in my service, for I am pleased with him." So you see that Saul did appreciate the music playing that David did. In fact, kind of gave him some other positions, appointed him armor bearer, asked Jesse to let him stay. During these experiences, you see this shepherd boy from Bethlehem got to live in the palace of the king and live with the king and see the day-to-day occurrences of ruling the nation of Israel. So David's getting some experience about what this is about. Okay, some experience that he wouldn't otherwise get. Now there's some interesting stuff, because we now then go into chapter 17. And chapter 17 in the story of David and Goliath talks a little bit about that Saul doesn't know who David is. Now, these verses really are kind of pointing ahead to the time in chapter 18 where Saul enters David's service permanently. We'll see as we go on in chapter 17 that David comes and goes right at this time, and then it's not till chapter 18 that he actually comes in. So these verses are kind of speaking ahead. You can see at the end of chapter 17 in verses 55 to 58 that it's clear that Saul at this time really didn't pay much attention to David. He appreciated having the music there, but it was just this musician kid and didn't really know much about who David was until later on. So we see that David and Saul make connection, a little bit of connection here, but David gets to experience what life is like and what goes on inside the house of the king. All right? So, chapter 17. What happens? There's a town 15 miles west of Bethlehem called Succoth, and what happens there? Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Succoth in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damim between Succoth and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another with a valley between them. So what happened? Philistines brought their army in again. and we have the Philistines and the Israelites drawing up battle lines, and this is in the heart of Israel. This is not in Philistine territory. This is in Succah. This is 15 miles west of Bethlehem, right in the heart of Israel. Who's living in Bethlehem? David is. So we see that it's not far away from where he is. Okay? Philistines this time, though, you know, they've had a few defeats against the Israelites. Now this time they brought a secret weapon. What is that secret weapon? Verse 4. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels, which is 125 pounds. So it's pretty heavy, just his coat of armor. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point, just the iron point on it, weighed 600 shekels, which is 15 pounds, just for the spear point. Okay? His shield bearer went ahead of him. You know, he could only carry so much, I guess. But so you have this big giant that is their secret weapon. He wore this 125-pound armor suit, 15-pound spear point. He's 9 foot tall, big guy. So what is the challenge of this secret weapon? What makes him the secret weapon here? Verse 8, Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not just a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Come on, choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I overcome him and kill him, then you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, this day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man, and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. So he set out a challenge and said, okay, why are we lining up for battle? Instead of lining up for battle, let's just make this easy. Instead of us killing all of us, you pick your best guy and have him come down and fight me. And whoever wins that battle, that wins the war. Okay? That wins this battle. And you, if I win, then y'all are subject to us. If he wins, then we're subject to you. Fair enough? Well, seems fair enough, except for this guy's 9 feet tall, heavily armored, and you see the response of the Israelites is they are scared. Now the point of that is that it's not just man against man, it's also the gods would decide, okay? We've got our gods, Dagon, and our gods against you and your god, Yahweh. We'll see whose god is really stronger. We'll see who is really stronger. Why take the whole army into this? Just let the gods work through two people. Saul has this challenge before him. He needs to find somebody who will go and risk their life and fight this guy. How does he do so? What incentive does he offer for whoever kills Goliath? Verse 25. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He'll also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel." Okay, so there's all these bonuses of incentives of great wealth and getting to marry into the family and be a prince. And your family would be tax exempt. So there's a lot of benefits for someone who would risk their lives and go out and fight this man. But no one would. And no one would. And no one would. How long? How long did this go on and no one would? Verse 16. For 40 days the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. So 80 times, 40 days, twice a day, he'd come out there, offer his challenge, and nobody would respond. That sets the stage. Now, who's there? We know this is 15 miles away from Bethlehem, which is where Jesse's family is, and David is one of his sons, and so they're all there. Was David in this army? Was he part of this army here at this time? 13 to 15. Jesse's three oldest sons had followed Saul to the war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The three oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So we see that David was not in the army. His three oldest brothers were, but he wasn't. And we do see that David went back and forth from Saul And this is where we see when he was going back and forth to play the harp, and then he would go back and tend some sheep, and then he'd come back and forth like that. Okay, now at this time, though, he was back. What caused David to show up in the army camp for our story here? Verse 17. Now Jesse said to his son David, "Take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along also these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them. They're with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines." So Jesse wanted to hear about how his sons were. Okay, Jesse was getting old, which we see back in verse 12. He is old and well advanced in years. And he wanted to hear, how's Eliab, how's Abinadab, how's Shammah? So he sends his youngest son, David, to go check up. But he can't just go. He sends some gifts. He sends some gifts for the commander and some food for his sons to make sure his sons are eating and taken care of. So what does David see when he arrives at the Israelite camp? Verse 22. Well, I'll start at verse 20. Early in the morning, David left the flock with a shepherd, loaded up, and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle position, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of the supplies, ran to the battle lines, and greeted his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. When the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear. So David gets there. He knows, hey, the Israelites are going to be fighting the Philistines. He gets there, and the battle hadn't started yet. And then he gets there in time for Goliath to step out and offer his challenge and shout his curses and whatever it is that he says. And then he sees the reaction of the Israelite army, and they're afraid of him. Okay? They back up because they're afraid. So how does David respond to what it is that he saw? Verse 26, David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" He said, how can you stand by and let this heathen curse God and curse God's people like this and defy God's army? How can you let that happen? You know, why didn't somebody go take care of him? You know, surely the king will do something for someone who kills this guy off. What's he going to do for him? Okay, so he's talking and asking these kind of questions. You see he's standing up boldly saying, "This guy's a nobody. You know, we got God on our side." How does Eliab, his oldest brother, react to David's big talk? While Eliab was cowering with all the rest of the soldiers. Verse 28, when Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You only came down here to watch the battle." Okay? What are you talking this big talk for? You know, you don't have your life on the line like the rest of us here. You just want to come down and watch some bloodshed. Shut up and go back home, you little runt. Hey, did David listen to his brother? Shut up and leave and go back home? Verse 29. "What have I done?" said David. "Can't I even speak?" You kind of see this brotherly love here, right? He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. Okay, so now he didn't shut up and leave. He kept talking and kept talking to others. And word came back to Saul about this kid that's in the camp that's talking this big talk. And so Saul, hey, bring him here. Okay, you know, number one, I can't have him demoralizing the troops here. But number two, if he's talking this big talk and wants to do something about it, you know, bring him here. Let me see him. So, what does David offer to Saul? David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant, I'll go and fight him." Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a boy. And he's been fighting man from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it. I struck it, and I rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, and I struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he's defied the armies of the living God. The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So Saul said, okay, God go with you. So he said, I'll fight Goliath. Don't be afraid. I'm your fighter here. God's going to give me victory. He's given me victory. He's allowed me to fight the lion and fight the bear, and I've defeated them both with my hands. I can certainly fight this stinking Philistine. He's nothing. Okay? So, Saul agrees. So, how well was David outfitted for this battle? Verse 38. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put on a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on the sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he wasn't used to him. I can't go in these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to him. So he took him off. And then he took his staff in his hand. He chose 5 stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with a sling in his hand, approached the Philistines. So remember, this Philistine has got a 125-pound coat of armor on, in this bronze helmet, and this big old spear with a 15-pound spear point on it, and he's heavily armored. David goes out with nothing. He goes out, he's dressed like a shepherd boy, because he is a shepherd boy. He's got no armor on, no sword, okay, not even carrying a sword. He just has a slingshot and a stick, a staff, a shepherd's staff. That's it. You know, what kind of weaponry is that? So he goes out very poorly outfitted as a man, as a soldier. But he's a man after God's heart, and he's going very well outfitted with God. You've seen he doesn't feel like there's any chance here. He's got God on his side. So Goliath is out there throwing these curses out and throwing this challenge out, and then out walks this little runt boy, this ruddy, childlike looking boy, no armor on, with a slingshot. What does he think? Verse 41. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. Okay? So he thought, okay, what's the deal? Can't you do any better than this? You're sending a little boy out here? Come on. Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? Now, you don't even have any weaponry on him. Did David agree that the fight would be one-sided? Verse 45. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day, Yahweh will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. So he says, you're saying you're going to give me to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. I'm going to give the whole Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. And the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by the sword or the spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. So did David feel it was one-sided? Yes, but he felt it was one-sided on his side because it's God's side. Yes, this is an unmatched battle. Everybody's thinking it's unmatched because Goliath is this 9-foot-tall, big warrior, and against this little boy David with no weaponry and no armor. David realizes it's one-sided because he's got God on his side and Goliath has nothing. Okay? The battle is the Lord's. He's going into this battle with his confidence that he's got God with him. Okay? Now, when the battle's about to begin, Does he still have that confidence, or does he get scared and turn away? Verse 48. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Okay, look at his confidence in God in action here. Okay, the big giant is getting closer and closer and has a battle stance and is ready to kill him. That's not scaring David. In fact, David can't wait. He starts running towards Goliath. Okay, why was it important for David to win without a sword or armor? Well, let's look at the rest of the battle here. Verse 49. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. So, David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. Okay, so why was that important? There's no way on earth that a boy with a slingshot could kill this mighty, huge warrior. But he did. And that's because there's no way under earth, but there's a way under God. And it showed God's power, and it built David's faith as well as the faith of the people who watched. How did the Philistines react when they saw what happened? Verse 51. David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from the scabbard. After he killed him, he cut off his head with a sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Yeah, even though the deal was that your guy kills me, then we become your subjects. No, that's not what they wanted, you know. But they're now afraid, and so they turn and they run. What was the result of David's trust in God here? Verse 52. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron, two of the big cities of the Philistines. Their dead were strewn along the Sha'arim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, and he put the Philistine's weapons in his own tent. Okay? So the Israelites slaughtered the Philistines, and there was a great victory for the Israelites as a result of the strong faith of this boy who wasn't afraid of this monster Goliath. And the physical force that Goliath posed, but the spiritual force overwon that David had with him on his side. Now this leads to another problem that we're going to talk about more next week that creates more of a problem for Saul. You see in chapter 18, verses 6 to 9. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out of all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs, and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They've credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but with me, only thousands? What more can he get but the kingdom?" Yeah, we know that. And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. And that will get us into next week. Let's pray. God, our Father, we thank you for the example of David. We thank you for the faith that he exhibited throughout his life, the relationship that he had with you, the boldness that he approached life because he knew that you were with him. Help us see that faith is there for us as well. The Spirit that worked in David's life from the time that the Spirit came on him as anointing for the rest of his life is the same Spirit that you have poured into our lives from our baptism. The power that he had to be faithful and to be righteous in your eyes is the same power that we have as long as we live as people with hearts after your heart. We look to you for guidance and out of love and obedience, just as David did. Help us to see more about David as an example for our lives in our upcoming studies, but help us to live our lives with hearts that seek after yours. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.